Because he has achieved his real identity, the perfectly realized soul has no conception of how the material body is moving or acting, just as an intoxicated person cannot understand whether or not he has clothing on his body. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. This stage of life is explained by Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. A person whose mind is completely dovetailed with the desire of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and who engages 100% in the service of the Lord forgets his material bodily demands. So, I always wondered what this meant. There's another verse that says the same thing. I was trying to understand what it meant, so I looked up this one. Let's see, this one says, just as a drunken man does not notice if he is wearing his coat or shirt, similarly, one who is perfect in self-realization and who has thus achieved his eternal identity does not notice whether the temporary body is sitting or standing. Indeed, if by God's will the body is finished, or if by God's will he obtains a new body, the self-realized soul does not notice. Just as a drunken man does not notice the situation of his outward dress. So this is some report telling us the state of consciousness of the self-realized soul. Of course, one can immediately ask, well, in that case, how does the person conduct his affairs? Because if he doesn't notice what his body is doing, and if you talk with him, who are you talking with, for example? Maybe someone will have some insight. The only understanding I can intuitively arrive at of this is that it's not that the self-realized soul has absolutely no knowledge of what his body is doing, but he's not concerned with it. And the demands of the body and mundane mind and senses and so forth don't bother him. So there's sort of like background noise or something like that. I suppose you could make maybe an analogy of somebody having a conversation with someone, and in the background all kinds of noise may be going on, but the people don't notice, although in one sense they do notice, but they don't particularly pay attention. Anyway, that's about as far as my insight goes, which isn't particularly far. So, a topic about which I could speak with greater authority would be the state of the conditioned living entity, and the consciousness of the living entity who is influenced by the three modes of material nature. So, let's see. There are some interesting verses in this 11th canto which refer to that. Let's see. First of all, there's an interesting definition of death. It goes as follows. When the living entity passes from the present body to the next body, which is created by his own karma, he becomes absorbed in the pleasurable and painful sensations of the new body and completely forgets the experience of the previous body. This total forgetfulness of one's previous material identity, which comes about for one reason or another, is called death. So that's a interesting definition of death. Death is the forgetfulness of the previous body. So, because sometimes people ask, well, if you lived before, then why don't you remember that? And this would answer that death actually, by definition, is the process of forgetfulness of the previous life, which enables you to become absorbed in another life. So, of course, one might ask, why is it done in this way? It seems that karma is delivered in chunks. So you have it's sort of like it's quantized. We can borrow terminology from physics. In physics, energy goes by quantum jumps with no transition in between. So it seems that karma comes in quantized units known as lives. So one life is terminated, and you forget about that. And then based on the karma that you've accumulated, you start over again with a new life. That seems to be the circumstance. So then there's a definition of birth here. O most charitable Uddhava, what is called birth is simply a person's total identification with a new body. One accepts the new body just as one completely accepts the experience of a dream or a fantasy as reality. So, let's see, just as a person experiencing a dream or daydream does not remember his previous dreams or daydreams, a person situated in his present body, although having existed prior to it, thinks that he has only recently come into being. So this is the situation in which we find ourselves. So the self-realized soul comes to recognize his own true identity. But at least, even if we're not self-realized, we can try to understand theoretically what our real identity is so that we can act in such a way, act in a way that will be conducive to developing self-realization. So we have this discussion of the relationship between the soul, the subtle body, and the gross body. And this is useful for guiding us in the matter of attaining self-realization. So there are some interesting descriptions here describing the nature of the material body. The soul is actually a substantial entity and is eternally existing. So the material body, however, is actually a sequence of transformations of some underlying energy which is quite distinct from the material body itself. Sometimes it's described that the material elements enter into the body, but at the same time they don't enter. You can see intuitively what that would mean. Consider, for example, that there's carbon in your body. Actually, there's quite a bit of carbon. You could make quite a number of lead pencils from it. One could say that to a carbon atom, it doesn't really make any difference whether it's in your body or it's in the lead of a pencil. Because, well, for the carbon atom, it's the same thing. It's just doing what carbon atoms do. The same for an atom of hydrogen or nitrogen or whatever. So looked at from that point of view, your body doesn't really exist. Because if you take any given atom in your body, that's just an arrangement of, whatever an atom really is. The scientists speak of valence bonds and all this kind of thing. But the atom is just situated in a particular condition. Likewise, an atom of the same type situated in a piece of dead matter is bonded to certain other atoms. It's situated in a particular situation. So your body is just the sum total of all those atoms. So in that sense, the body doesn't really exist. Of course, it does exist, but what exists there is really only the pattern formed by the atoms in that particular arrangement. Just as if you put dots on a piece of paper, you can create a letter. So the letter is just the sum total of the dots on the piece of paper. By putting together letters, you can create a word, a sentence, or an entire book that expresses a whole elaborate idea. But all you've got are dots on a piece of paper. So that's what the body is like. So there are verses here that describe that idea. For example, it stated, the different stages of transformation of all material bodies occur just like those of the flame of a candle, the current of the river, or the fruits of a tree. So you can consider the current of a river. You may think a river is a permanent thing, but actually, at one given moment in time, you have particular bits of water that are there, and then a little while later, there'll be other bits of water moving in a different way. And there's constant transformation going on. So in one sense, there's no river. There are just many different instances of rivers. And you just lump them together and you say, this is the river. As far as the flame of the candle, this is, Krishna describes this in greater detail in the next verse. Actually, this sounds like physics, actually, also. It says, although the illumination of a lamp consists of innumerable rays of light undergoing constant creation, transformation, and destruction, a person with illusory intelligence who sees the light for a moment will speak falsely, saying, this is the light of the lamp. So, the physicists also say that photons are being produced by a source of light. So they're constantly being created and annihilated when they hit things and are absorbed. So, in one sense, it's false to say that that is the light, because really there are just particular photons being created and annihilated, and that's always changing. It's never the same from one moment to the next. So the idea of the light is actually false. Or here again, the river. As one observes a flowing river, ever new water passes by and goes far away. Yet a foolish person, observing one point in the river, falsely states, this is the water of the river. Similarly, although the material body of a human being is constantly undergoing transformation, those who are simply wasting their lives falsely think and say that each particular stage of the body is the person's real identity. So, this is the situation of the material body. Now, in contrast to this, the soul actually exists. So in the case of the soul, if you say this is the soul, then you'd be right, because the soul has substantial reality. It's an actual existing thing, whereas the body is a process which is just a succession of states of something else different from the body, whether it be atoms or quantum fields or the elements of Sankhya philosophy. You could describe it in different ways, but the same idea comes across. So in that sense, the body is not really the self at all, and in one sense, it doesn't really exist. This virtual reality metaphor also is useful for illustrating this. So nowadays, they've been able to create what they call virtual realities within computers. So the way this works is that you have an apparatus which covers the senses of an individual. So this could consist of an arrangement that puts little TV cameras in front of TV screens in front of the eyes, so that what you see is what is on the TV screens. And then you could have earphones over the ears, so that what you hear is coming in from the earphones. And one could even go further and put some sort of form-fitting suit on the body, so that what you feel is also transmitted to you by the computer. And then your bodily motions are transferred back into the computer by another sensory link-up. So the computer takes the data that it's getting from your body, plus programming that it has, and it calculates a scene in which there are different bodies and different objects and so forth. And one of these bodies is linked up with your senses. And the result of this is that you are under the illusion that you are that body, because the senses are hooked up so that you're seeing from the point of view of the eyes of that body, and you're hearing from the point of view of the ears of that body. You would be feeling from the point of view of what that body is supposedly touching. So the effect that this has is that the person linked up with the virtual reality is under the impression that they are there in the virtual reality in that body. And the illusion can be quite astonishing. Another way of doing this is the mechanical method with something called a telerobot. What you do is you build a robot, you give it TV camera eyes and microphone ears and little servo motors for muscles and so forth. And you then link up the person's senses with that. It's described that this was done once in Japan. So the person was in the telerobot, so to speak. He was looking around and feeling that this is where he was. And the other people were there, and he was talking with them, shaking hands, and all that sort of thing. And they said, look over in the corner of the room there. So he looked over in the corner of the room and experienced a shock. At this point, he had an out-of-body experience because he saw his own body sitting in the corner of the room. And he was identifying with the robot. So this looked like somebody else's body, but he realized it was his body. And it was rather shocking to him. So this shows the, in one sense, how easy it is to become identified with a false bodily form. So if you go back to this computer example, though, even though you're under the illusion that you're in a body and you're performing different activities within an environment, the body and the environment don't exist. Actually, the only thing that is there is the computer, which is doing computations. So it has memory storage areas, and numbers are stored there, and it's retrieving numbers, multiplying them, dividing them, and so on, putting the numbers back. And that's all that's really happening in the machine. There's no body there at all. But there is a transformation of stages of something which is not a body. So in that sense, it's completely analogous to the situation of these bodies. Just a series of transformations. Anyway, so this is the situation of the material body. Are there any questions or comments? Yeah?
If you told me this is a personal letter, you were not ever into consciousness as such.
Yeah.
So that may affect your ability to understand. and that seems, my question would be, given the example of the like the robot, the person who's hooked up to the, what would you call it, electro robot?
Telerobot.
Telerobot. Apparently he forgot his, you know, present body. So could you just sort of reverse that, you know, and use that for an analogy to understand, you know, the state of the self-realized soul regarding his, when he gets tuned into his spiritual body, maybe.
Well, yeah, that's the... Yeah, you could switch it around that way. The self-realized soul, well, he's realized a self, so what does that mean? What is the self anyway? So you actually have a spiritual body. In fact, you are that spiritual body. But in the conditioned state of consciousness, we're unaware of that, just as a person in a dream is unaware of his gross body. Dreams also are a good example for this. It's amazing how one falls into an illusion in a dream, because you can be dreaming some totally ridiculous thing, and while the dream is going on, that's all that you know. It happens every night, practically. So the power of illusion is really incredible. But so our spiritual bodies exist, and that's what we are, but right now we're dreaming this material dream. But the self-realized soul is presumably aware of his spiritual body. He's self-realized. And so to him, the physical body is not so important. He doesn't pay much attention to it. And of course, a self-realized soul can really go into what would be called a state of trance, in which he engages in some spiritual pastime and completely ignores the material body. There are so many examples. For example, Lord Chaitanya would do that. Of course, he was merely, well, let's say, illustrating the situation for others, because his body is not actually a material body, since he's Krishna himself. But at least he was illustrating the idea, because his external body would apparently go unconscious, and he would be experiencing the Leela of Radha and Krishna. He'd be making garlands for Radha and Krishna and so forth and so on. Of course, many great saints have engaged in this sort of trance state. Was it, just trying to think which one it was. I think this, it was either Narottam Das Thakur or Srinivas Acharya, I forget which one. But the description was there that this saintly personality was sitting in a state of trance. His external body was inactive, and internally he was fanning Lord Chaitanya in the spiritual realm, which means he was doing that with his spiritual body. And Lord Chaitanya turned and placed his garland around his neck, and this broke his meditation. And he woke up, and actually this amazing garland was around his neck. So there are quite a number of accounts like that. Of course, there's the one in Krishna book also about the Brahmin who was meditating on devotional service because he was very poor. He couldn't afford elaborate paraphernalia to for deity worship and so on. So in his meditation, he was making this sweet rice and put his finger in the sweet rice to see if it was cool yet. It wasn't, and it burned his finger. And then his finger was burned. So a bit of feedback between the spiritual realm and the gross physical realm. Yeah?
You mentioned about suffering myself, not relating to the body. For example, probably once he had a half-strap tooth, causing a lot of pain. There was some preaching days that night. They took some either carnivore or one of the spices, they just sucked on him.
Yeah, well, he's certainly an example. He was just like the last volume of the 10th canto that he translated. That was done when he was in a condition in which doctors said he must be suffering intense pain. Now, I do have experience of pain. Not really intense pain, but it's certainly not easy to compose sentences and so forth in that condition. But Srila Prabhupada was doing it. Yeah?
When you talk about the soul being unmanifest,
mm-hmm.
by the process of bhakti, it becomes manifest. I've heard devotees say, and I just want to give you some feedback. Is the soul in its unmanifest state like a child in the womb, or everything's there, but in potentiality, undeveloped? Or is it, because sometimes, and a lot of times it says, why does the body have form if the soul has form? But are both kinds of statements there about the soul specifically, in relation to, is the soul in its unmanifest form, like a seed or, like that kind of state, or is it always with?
Well, there are so many descriptions of the soul as being exceedingly small within the gross body, 1/10,000th the tip of a hair in size, and it's always being presented as a spark and so forth. So that aspect is certainly there. But Srila Prabhupada has indeed said on various occasions that just as a glove has five fingers and so on, because the hand has fingers and form, so likewise the material body has form because of the underlying form of the soul. And if the soul is eternal, then its form must exist in some fashion. So, I don't know any, does anyone know any, you have any reference on that?
The sixth chapter, probably on the yoga system tapes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if it made it into the book. But one devotee asked Prabhupada, the soul of 1,000,000 parts of the hair, does that mean that he's always that size in the spiritual world?
Mm-hmm.
He's still 1,000,000. And so he was asking this question, how does he have a body and so forth? So Prabhupada said, just as in the material world, the soul kind of expands in the sense of the size of the body. In other words, the soul is, for his conscience anyway, is expanding through the matter. In the spiritual world, he can expand in spirit. In other words, there's a size there, you know, it's not the same kind of thing in the material world. Obviously, the size and space are different. But you can engage just the right size, and Krishna is medium size, and also medium size, and so forth. So I think when the soul becomes manifest, it means he's starting to manifest, or starting to realize that form, even in the material world, through the process of bhakti, so he's using his senses, and he's realizing his spiritual sense of gratitude through that process. And the spiritual world is completely manifest, whatever form it is.
So would this mean that the soul has complete form, arms, legs, and everything, is 10,000th the tip of the hair in size, but in the spiritual world, he simply expands to the appropriate size. That, I guess, would make sense. Yeah. Well, I'd like to hear that one. Of course, the size that bodily forms take on undergoes great variation also. Because just like when Krishna and Arjuna went to see Mahavishnu, of course you've pointed out it wasn't exactly Mahavishnu, but in any case, their bodies must have changed in size. Either that or Mahavishnu shrank down. It would have to be one or the other, because how could they meet and have a conversation? So, and of course, even materially, the Mahima city and Anima city enable one to change the size of the material body, if you have that city, so that the material body can be reduced down so that it could fit into a pore within a stone, or it can be expanded to enormous size. Hanuman was fond of doing that. He would expand himself up to the size of a mountain and create earthquakes by jumping around and things like that. So, if that's even possible for the material body by the mystic city, then consider what the soul might be able to do.